This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And before we get to our array of guests today, note that John Schroeder and Derek Edwards are in a runoff for treasurer after Saturday's voting. The LSU football Tigers are suddenly resurgent after defeating Auburn 27-23, coming back from a 20-point deficit. The Saints were victorious yesterday, 52-38 over Detroit. And on a sad note, one person is missing. Seven have been hospitalized after an oil rig explosion in Lake Pontchartrain just north of Kenner last night. The officials say that all people injured in the explosion were either on the rig or an adjacent barge. Jefferson Parish Sheriff Joe Lapinto says some sort of cleaning was being done on the platform, but an official cause of the explosion has not been made, and the U.S. Coast Guard said one man on the rig was not able to make it to shore after the explosion, and search efforts continue in an effort to find him. So we'll be following this story on WRKF as the day moves along today. 877-217-5757 is your number. If you're dialing locally in Baton Rouge, you can dial us at 297-5633. The email is talk@talklouisiana.org. And later in the hour, we're going to hear from the new chief administrative officer for East Baton Rouge Parish, the top aide to Mayor Sharon Weston Broome, Daryl Gissel, also Nancy Cohen from the Harvard Business School. But we begin with Zia Tamami. Zia is a voice that is familiar to many of us in this community. He's been on the air for 40 years, since May 17th, 1977, to be exact. And, Allie, do we have his distinctive theme music from Spontaneous Combustion? If you've listened to Zia for the last 40 years, you've bound to have heard this a time or two.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good to have you with us.
How do they spell it?
They spell it J-double-Z, and it goes like this.
There you go. Well, Zia, who is worthy of many accolades, will be on hand Wednesday, and he will be along with several other luminaries as part of the River City Jazz Masters series. This event is one that has gained steam through the years, and tell us about what's going to happen in a couple of nights.
It's going to be really exciting. It's a tribute to Professor Batiste and the gentleman who established the Jazz Institute, and rightfully so, they named the institute after him. So his family is going to be there, and Victor Goines, who used to be a member of Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and still traveling with him, he's going to come with his quartet and bringing some surprise guests. Hopefully Stephanie Jordan's going to be there, and many other alumni. So it's going to be a very exciting night and beautiful setting. Some of the LSU staff and faculties, they're going to join, and Southern University professors, some of the retired professors. So it's exciting. It's a reunion, wonderful night. That's 7:30 Wednesday night at Manship, and about 6:15 we have a reception on the fourth floor. Music and food, so come by and say hello and shake hands. This should be a wonderful program.
Yes, indeed. And this is a community that has embraced jazz, and part of it is because of you. For 40 years, you've been preaching the mantra of jazz in all its glory, and you found a niche here.
Well, you know, being away from New Orleans, you know, we always thought, you know, Baton Rouge, you got to do something about the jazz. So about 11 years ago, when Derek Gordon, God bless his soul, came down from Kennedy Center, got together with us, architects of the River City Jazz Coalition, Connie Lewis, myself, our dear colleague C.J. Blush, Leo Hamilton, Dr. Bill Grimes, and Professor Batiste, and we kicked off this journey, and 11 years later, we brought premier jazz that sometimes you don't get a chance to see them in New Orleans, in Baton Rouge. And now East and West Coast, they're talking about us. And when I talk to some of these jazz distributors and what they're called, jazz lobbyists,
yeah,
and they say, how do you guys do this in Baton Rouge? So it's incredible, and thanks to the support and River City Jazz Coalition members and, of course, the Art Council of the Greater Baton Rouge, now Renee Shatlin and Jonathan Grimes and the staff, they're really doing a wonderful job to make this program happen.
Well, Vic, your backstory, Zia, is amazing. You came here from Iran.
From Tehran,
And what year was that?
That was 1971-72, era.
1972, and it took a few years, but you got on then WLSU.
Well, those were the days. I mean, you remember that. You know, well, it was broadcasting only on closed circuit on campus, and then... and we had all sort of interesting characters. You know, some of them, they went on to big-time talk shows and weather personalities. And really, when I compare that era that you were there and other colleagues to what we're getting now, it's like a world of difference. People that show up with their laptops, they're not knowing anything about the music. Everybody just, you know, that's this, you know... sort of a status of the radio these days.
Well, you and I were there together. You started a few years before I did. I was started in 79, but you were there 1977 in the bowels of Tiger Stadium.
Oh,
wasn't that great?
Those East Stadium. And vividly remember during the winter, we had these hot water pipes all around the station because we were in the bottom of the dormitory in East Stadium. So at night, when we were doing the show, these guys that were banging on the pipes, and we can hear it in the studio live, and people that were calling said, are you in a submarine? Those were the days, but, you know, radio changed, but still it's amazing after all these new technologies and all the digital world, you know, still people that are listening to radio, so that's fascinating.
And Baton Rouge is a good place to live in part because of the two major universities, the people from all over the world are here.
Absolutely.
And then the other beautiful thing about it is that a lot of our cohorts, they move away, they go to other places, and now, by virtue of the World Wide Web, they're able to listen to Zia Tamam.
Exactly. I mean, now we have a Snapchat at LSU Radio, KLSU, and 3 weeks ago, or almost a month ago, you know, I was on the air, and we got a Snapchat from London. And this gentleman said, it's a balmy day in London, but the music is good. So I play some Ella and Louis, A Foggy Day in London time. So they loved it. So we get emails, calls, you know, people that are listening to us in Persian Gulf in Dubai.
Really?
Yes. We got email from Czech Republic, from Johannesburg, South Africa, listening to Dinner Jazz. So it's exciting. Yeah.
Well, you're a jazz purist. You don't much like this so-called elevator jazz, do you?
No, there's a place for it, but I don't need to really get involved with that. My mission is to educate and entertain, and there's a lot of great music there. But at the same time, I am not restricted to all these checking the boxes that this is a hard bop, this is a post bop, this is a swing, this is big band. You know, if it's good music, I'll play it.
When did you start this affinity with jazz?
When I was, I think, about 7 or 8. I went to the first concert when I was 5 to see Dizzy Gillespie in Tehran. And then I went to see Ahmad Jamal when I was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. I saw Max Roach when I was 13 years old. And then I saw Max Roach at Southern, and I told him I was in the crowd when he played at the ruins of Cyrus the Great in Persepolis when Shah of Iran was there. And he couldn't believe it. But early days, you know, my parents, they played Latin music, classical music, rock, and jazz. And that's the beauty of it, to be exposed.
As I recall, I think I remember you telling me you met Duke Ellington in a men's room.
Exactly. I was. We were waiting for my brother to fly back with Pan American Airline. This is before even the jets, flying from Tehran to London and then to Michigan State. So we're at the lobby of Tehran International Airport. So I went to the men's room, washing my hands, standing next to this guy that looks like a movie star. And he combed his hair and walked out, and I went and told my brother, did you see that guy? it looks like a movie star. And he very sort of a nonchalant said, well, that's Duke Ellington. Really? I said, yeah, they were there on behalf of the State Department. And they were coming back from city of Isfahan, which is, if you go to Isfahan, you've seen half of the world. That's how you say about the architecture that dates back thousands of years. So when he got to Washington, they wrote the song Isfahan as part of his repertoire.
Zia Tamami is with us. We'll talk more about what's going to happen this Wednesday, 7:30, at the Manship Theater. There will be a performance honoring the great Alvin Batiste. Victor Goins will also be on hand. He was a student of the late Alvin Batiste, and he will be performing a tribute show. And I don't know if we're going to be able to get through to Victor today, but we will hear from him by way of his music, and we look forward to hearing from you if you're so inclined. 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Zia Tamami is with us, the veteran jazz announcer, 40 years of spontaneous combustion on the LSU station. He also does a show on WBRH, Jazz on the Half Shell. And Zia will be honored in a way Wednesday night, along with the great Alvin Batiste, the late great Alvin Batiste, at the Manship Theater. It's part of the River City Jazz Masters series, and Victor Goins will be performing, the saxophonist and clarinetist from New Orleans, world-renowned. And before we get back to Zia, if you're so inclined, 877-217-5757 is our number, but here is Victor Goins. Victor Goins, quite a performer, and you can see him Wednesday, 7:30, Manship Theater. And Zia, John Word had a very nice piece on you in the Friday Advocate in the red section, and you said that you used to listen to Voice of America.
I tell you, there was nothing like it. We were listening to Top of the Hour news. Right after the news, it was Willis Conover of Voice of America. He's a gentleman that a lot of people said that defeated communism in Russian blocs and Eastern Europe. And I was mesmerized the way he delivered. And, of course, probably 25 million listeners that they were listening to him, 70 or 80% couldn't speak a word of English. So he was talking very slow with a beautiful diction. And after listening to him, I said, man, I want to be just like him. So he really inspired me.
All right, a listener at talklouisiana.org wants to know how you ended up at LSU of all places by way of Tehran.
Interesting. I had three scholarships. I had LSU, I had Michigan State, and I got University of Arizona. And, of course, University of Arizona and Michigan State, my brothers, they went there, they got their PhDs, and one of them is teaching at the University of Arizona. So I want to be a petroleum geologist. So they said LSU has a top 10 geology school in the nation. I said, well, let's go check it out. They said, well, if you don't like it, then you can transfer. So I came here. Next thing you know, we're going forward and LSU radio and all that good stuff. And met my wife from Lake Charles, and here we are 40-some-odd years later.
You've been in Baton Rouge 45 years.
Correct, yes.
Do you get back to Iran?
Haven't been back since 1975. Of course, you know, everything changed, and what we knew is not the same. You know, it's a different era. It's a different culture. So, but I'm excited that maybe one of these days take a really nice band from New Orleans and go to Tehran and as part of a cultural exchange, do that. So looking forward to that.
And there are a number of Iranian people in Baton Rouge.
There are about 300 PhD students just at LSU. I mean, they are upcoming. They're very bright and a real nice community. There are a few well-known surgeons in New Orleans, a few scientists working for NASA. They're all from Iran. Very, very good group of people.
Do they all like jazz as much as you?
Probably not. No, I'm interesting enough. I haven't come across one Persian jazz radio announcer yet. So,
Well, we have some great restaurants.
Beautiful, absolutely.
In this community.
Yes, the Mediterranean,
and that's probably a testament to the number of people from the Middle East who live
exactly,
in this area.
Exactly. You know, this is a really beauty. I mean, people that are complaining they don't have a Mediterranean or Middle Eastern restaurants even in big cities. So here we are with probably about 15 of them just in Baton Rouge.
When did you develop your passion for Frank Sinatra?
Well, Frank, you know, I was, I think, 14, 15 years old, and my oldest brother, he came to visit us from Geneva, Switzerland, and he brought this album, Ellington Meets Sir Francis Sinatra. And it was out of this world. A lot of people that haven't heard that. And it's Ellington and with his big band, with Johnny Hodges and all those guys.
Room.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I like The Sunrise. It's one of my favorites. Sonny is another one. So when I heard that,
Sonny,
it was like, wow. You know, that's you know, Ellington behind Sinatra, that's something else.
And you play Frank Sinatra on your show every Sunday at noon, and it's a tribute to the great one who would have been 102 years old come December the 12th. But Frank Sinatra lives on with his music, and I guess he always will. He was, according to many, the singer of the century, and that was not only a U.S. phenomenon, it was
worldwide. You know, quick story, the famous saxophone player Lester Young took a break from a gig in New York, went across the street to get a pack of cigarettes, and the guy was playing Sinatra. And he said, "What is this? Is that Sinatra?" The guy said, "Yeah." He was playing Dancing in the Dark. He said, "I got to take this style and play it on my sax to show you just how big the guy was."
You know? Yeah. Well, you developed this affinity, and it's apparent how much you love his music. And you had one of the last interviews with his son.
That was incredible. All these interviews that I've done, this was something else because he was in a bad mood, and we thought we're not going to survive 5 minutes. And we went on for 25 minutes, and that was the last interview he did before his passing. It was a great interview.
He was not pleased with the way life had turned out for him.
No, very disappointed with the family, with the recording business. It was very bitter, and toward the end, he apologized to our listeners for being so negative.
So grumpy. another listener, Doug, asks, is your show the longest jazz show in the country?
In North America, correct.
In North America.
In North America. Yeah, there's another gentleman. There's another gentleman. He's 2 years behind me. He's on XM Radio, but he's been on the air only about maybe 37 years or so.
Well, we hope for many more years.
Thank you.
Zia is still a very spry guy, and Victor Goings will be with him Wednesday. And for those unfamiliar with him, he's pretty strong.
Victor
too.
Goings, if you haven't seen solos, both master sax and clarinet, you got to see him. And he's a good friend of Herlin Riley and all those guys who studied under Mr. Batts. So it should be a very special night. Come see us.
And Alban Batiste, what an influence he had on so many.
He was my mentor, and I tell you, he is a giant. A lot of people that are looking at him locally. The guy was world-renowned and influenced so many big names and incredible institute that he left behind and still going real well.
What gets you juiced up about this? You're an engineer by training, and you do have a day job, but on Sundays you devote it to your passion.
It's nothing like improvise and even surprise yourself. I don't have a playlist. I don't do things ahead of time. I don't believe in that. So when I get on stage, it's like a cook in the you know, on the show on television, and just putting stuff together, and all of a sudden it tastes real good.
Michael Foster calling from Southern University. Michael, quite a jazz man himself. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi, and hello to you, Zia.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I just wanted to make the comment to let everybody know that Zia's show has not only brought together musicians and introduced them to another world of music, but he's also brought families together. He said he was able to go to see these shows when he was a young man or a young boy. And a lot of other families, including my own, have been able to do the same through him. So I just wanted to call in and say thank you for that, Zia.
Oh, it's good to hear from you, Michael. Michael's been absolutely great. And by the way, very quick, if we have like maybe a minute.
We've got about 20 seconds.
TV 5 Monde, the French television came, did the documentary, broadcasted worldwide. I'm part of it, and Michael Foster is part of that documentary. So if you get a chance, check it out.
Well, thank you for joining us, Zia.
Thank
you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks
and,
for inviting
Wednesday,
us.
7:30, Manship Theater, Victor Goins, Zia Tamami.
Happy jazzing.
And saluting Alvin Batiste. And we'll be back after. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, 297-5633. And the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Next, we're slated to hear from Daryl Gissel, the gentleman who is now the chief administrative officer for parish government, working under Sharon Weston Broome, our mayor. Right now, we have Nancy Cohen joining us from Italy, historian at the Harvard Business School. And she is one of our most dedicated guests to be with us across the pond in a big way. Her book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Good morning, or I guess it's good evening to you, Nancy, but hello, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And this is an important book, and certainly in these times we're looking for strong leaders, and people lead in different ways, and that's part of your book. You examine what's going on in our world with different people. And what is the power of courageous leadership?
Well, the power of courageous leadership, as I've told it in these five, what turned out to be jaw-dropping stories, right, dramatic stories of these five different individuals who found themselves, each of them, in different kinds of crises, buffeted by high winds and big waves, the power of courageous leadership was ultimately the power they discovered within themselves, not in one fell swoop, not in one big, you know, leap tall buildings in a single bound kind of gesture, but really, you know, step by step and wave by wave and high wind by high wind, how these individuals from Abraham Lincoln to Frederick Douglass to Rachel Carson, the environmentalist, and Ernest Shackleton, the Antarctic explorer, how they all discovered their own strength, resilience, courage, bravery, muscles of moral tautness and impact, and ultimately did that, discovered all that, and then used those inner resources, you know, in moments of great confusion to impact the world in service to a big, worthy mission. So these are stories of people who, in the mess of a crisis, got better and stronger. And the lessons of these stories are, we can do the same thing. And I offer the insights these people discovered as part of the narratives.
You mentioned Abraham Lincoln, as does just about every U.S. president. Inevitably, they start comparing themselves to Lincoln and showing reverence for the 16th American president who was cut down by an assassin's bullets. But Abraham Lincoln, in his time, was a very controversial man, and he had certainly his share of enemies. When you judge him by his time, does he stand as a giant in what he did?
Well, you know, he had a huge number of enemies, not only from, you know, in the South, in terms of the Confederate, the states that had succeeded in the Confederacy. Obviously, those folks weren't in favor of Mr. Lincoln's vision for America. But it wasn't just in the South. He had lots and lots of enemies in the North because the war was controversial. His policies in managing and leading that war were controversial. The emancipation was controversial. Absolutely. So he was in the midst, again, of a kind of perfect storm as president. But I think he stands the test of time, that is the hindsight that comes with history, I think he, at the, in the, in, during his presidency, some, by no means all, but some of his most virulent critics, including men within his own cabinet, who were very dubious about this inexperienced, you know, aw shucks lawyer from Central Illinois,
uh-huh.
some of his most virulent critics became big fans because I think, and I think a lot of people like Ulysses Grant, you know, not someone with a big political agenda, who really came to respect Lincoln, or William Tecumseh Sherman, I think, or Robert E. Lee at the end of his life, I think that Lincoln earned the respect of those people because of how he himself grew into the office of the presidency and into the moral seriousness that that office demanded at that time. So, yes, I think he stands both tests, contemporary standards as well as the criteria that hindsight affords.
And earlier this year, our current president, Donald Trump, he was talking about Frederick Douglass as though he were still alive. Frederick Douglass is a major historical figure. Why has he risen above the others when we judge him in his time?
Well, I mean, Douglass is a fascinating person. I did not know a lot about him when I set off to, when I stumbled into his story and got, you know, got my nose going and I started sniffing. He's fascinating because he, partly because of where he came from, right? Born into slavery in Maryland, escapes when he's 20. Before he escapes, he teaches himself to read and write. He gets himself to New York and then to New England in the 1830s and early 1840s, and becomes involved in the white man's abolitionist organization, the white man's abolitionist movement in Massachusetts and New England. And then, beginning really in the mid-1840s, breaks off on his own to form his own abolition movement, and tirelessly, I mean, and he, man, one of the great things about these stories is each of these people comes really close at numerous occasions to giving up because what they're trying to do is so hard. But Douglass, and as does Douglass, but tirelessly, ultimately, right, stubbornly, determinedly, he keeps on keeping on to build sentiment for abolition in the North among whites and freed and enslaved African Americans. And by the time Lincoln comes to be president, and then 2 years into Lincoln's presidency when he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, Douglass has made a huge contribution to changing or shifting political momentum enough in the North that Lincoln can issue that decree, change the game of the war, change American history, assuming the Union wins. But he could simply not have done all that without the kind of political groundwork, activist mm-hmm. groundwork that Douglass laid throughout the second half of the 1840s and throughout the 1850s.
The book is Forged in Crisis, from celebrated Harvard Business School historian Nancy Cohen. It spotlights five masters of crisis: Abe Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and another one is the polar explorer Ernest Shackleton. You obviously have great reverence for him.
That's an insightful remark. I do, because what he did in saving his men, for your listeners that don't know this story, and many people don't, Ernest Shackleton had sailed a crew of 27 men to Antarctica in late 1914, and his ship gets stuck literally like in a vise of icebergs off the coast of Antarctica in January 1915, and it's just drifting in the sea off the coast of Antarctica, no way to communicate with anyone, no way to, you know, stop the ship or get out of the ice. And then within 6 months, the ice crushes the ship, the men abandon ship, and Shackleton's mission, against all odds, is to get the 27 men home with three 24-foot lifeboats, some canned goods, and this indomitable will he had to save his men. So I know this story like the back of my hand. I'm still in awe of how he, again, over the course of almost 2 years, kept his men's faith that they would survive and kept enough of that faith within himself to actually do it. And the story is like out of the great Hollywood adventure stories. It's so incredible. So I admire him very much. Well, I, as a historian, who know his life well, can also see, you know, some of his many flaws and mistakes and blunders and weaknesses. So, but still, it's a story of triumph, the triumph of the human spirit in the end.
A riveting chapter is Confronting Nazi Aggression, and one of the people who did is one of the five people in your book.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, so he's probably the least well-known of these five, what my editor at Scribner calls the Fantastic Five. And for most Americans are not familiar with him. He was a clergyman, a Lutheran minister in Berlin when the Nazis took over. And from the get-go, he recognized the threat that Hitler and the National Socialists posed, not only to Jews and other people deemed enemies of the state, but also to world peace. And Bonhoeffer spends much of the 1930s as a pastor in an alternative church formed to protest the Nazi control of the Lutheran Church as well as Nazi policies. And then in about 1939, he's become disillusioned with the ability of that body to really combat this tightening use of evil. He's also, by the way, on every Gestapo watch list and in danger of being incarcerated and perhaps much worse. And he decides, right before the Second World War breaks out in the summer of 1939, that he's going to join the resistance inside the Nazi government as a double agent, and he spends the rest of his time working to try and assassinate Hitler and overthrow the Third Reich with a group of men inside the Nazi government. So this story, like the Shackleton story, again, is very dramatic. It's got this whole spy story piece to it, and yet, at its core, it's about this very brave man who was willing to undertake all kinds of danger because the alternative, letting the evil go unresisted, was unacceptable to him.
We're going to take a short break and continue our conversation with Nancy Cohen. Her book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, and the fifth person is one of the most memorable, environmental crusader Rachel Carson. She raced against the cancer ravaging her in a bid to save the planet. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Our email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. And we also will hear from Daryl Gissel if things go according to plan, the Chief Administrative Officer for Mayor President Sharon Weston Broome, East Baton Rouge Parish. She made her announcement last week to put one of her former opponents on her staff in the number one position. We'll return after this quick pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar producing, and Daryl Gissel is on deck. We're finishing up with Nancy Cohen. Her book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. We mentioned four of the five people that are focused upon in the book, and we don't want to miss the environmental crusader Rachel Carson, a true legend and certainly an admirable person if there ever was one, Nancy.
She is. I fell in love with each of these people as I spent many, many years writing this book, over 10 years, and so I had plenty of time to get to know them. But I have a very special place in my heart for Rachel, partly because she's the only woman, and partly because I'm a cancer survivor. She battled metastasizing cancer. But I think more than either of those things was, again, the sense that she's an unusual leader in the context of many of our preconceptions today about leadership. That she wrote Silent Spring, a book published in 1962, which more than any other single action by anyone else really laid the groundwork for the modern environmental movement. And again, in a practical, serious, right, doable frame. And she did all that not with, kind of a hard-charging, aggressive, charismatic way of doing things. She was quiet. She was shy. She worked alone. She was a woman in a man's world. She was in so many ways, a pathbreaker in her time and for our time, because she teaches us, like no other story in this book, that leaders come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and that you needn't be particularly aggressive or particularly you know, charismatic. She was quietly charismatic, but she was an introvert. And yet she is arguably as influential as any of the people in the book. So I think she's really a story that's absolutely unforgettable. And because she left a lot of letters and intimate portraits of her experience, we really get a sense in the chapter of how she worked through this very, very difficult situation. And so I think her story speaks to all kinds of people dealing with health crises and other turbulence in their lives, and how to do that, again, with grace and humanity and ultimately quiet triumph.
Well, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on an outstanding book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Joining us from Italy, Nancy Cohen. It's been a pleasure, Nancy.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Take care. See you soon. And we're joined now by Darryl Gissell. He, last time he was in this studio, was running for mayor. I think we talked to him on election day, and now he is working for the mayor, Sharon Weston Broom. How did this come about with you taking the CAO position?
Well, it really wasn't something I sought out. I happened to meet with Sharon a little over a week ago, to talk to her about blight and some suggestions for the city on dealing with blight. And in the middle of the conversation, Sharon told me, she said, it's no secret that I'm looking for a CAO. She said, could I talk to you about that position? And that's really how it ensued.
You had no idea?
No. I've offered to Sharon the whole way through that I'd do whatever I could to help. She named me to the Restore Louisiana Task Force. I helped her with the transition and went to speak the other day about the reform of community development, the community development part of the city. I share her vision for bringing people in Baton Rouge together. I think that's a secret to our success.
Well, it's a tough job.
No question.
And you'll essentially be the person responsible for running the show.
Right.
And you've got some administrative background, and I've talked with Darryl many times. We've noted that as far as the downtown revitalization, Darryl had as much to do with that, or maybe more than anybody else. But what's the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge we face in Baton Rouge really is bringing people together. I mean, we've seen over the last couple of years a split in the divide we have between North and South, the St. George breakaway effort, the eruption in North Baton Rouge about the lack of services, issues with policing, issues that really break us apart. And if we're going to be a progressive city, that needs to end. And I think the way that you really do end that is trying to make sure that everybody feels like they're being served.
Well, she certainly reached out to you, and you have a much different background than she does.
Exactly.
Darryl, in a different life, was a high-ranking member of the Republican Party in Louisiana. He ran last year as an independent, and now he's working for a Democrat. I would imagine 25 years ago you never thought it would turn out this way.
Oh, exactly. And I remember working in another race for a Democrat where we did a Republicans for campaign for the candidate. This candidate was a Democrat. And someone on the phone, when I explained that it was a Republican working for this Democrat, a responder said, well, you can't be much of a Republican if you're a turncoat. And I remember in the early days of the Republican Party effort in Louisiana, one of the questions that was always asked in a poll was, if you think the Republican candidate is better than the Democrat candidate, which one would you vote for? And it was always, we'd vote for the Democrat. I mean, we were a one-party state. So we've come a long way in terms of, you know, where we are in terms of party affiliation. Yeah. But now we're really, we're divided. The party label, I think, in my mind, is keeping us apart today. Mm-hmm. That's why I ran as an independent.
Now, I remember Mark Emmert, when he was chancellor at LSU, he launched a nationwide search for athletic director and ended up hiring the baseball coach who was right across the street.
Exactly.
This is kind of the same thing, isn't it?
And I think I've been on a lot of search committees for different groups, and in many cases, that's exactly what happens. And in some cases, I think it's hard to bring somebody in from the outside. You may get some different ideas, but the drawback is they don't know the local landscape. And I think right now Sharon has been amazed by the number of people who are offering help and have offered help. I've been amazed in the last couple of days how many people have come to me and said, we really want to help Baton Rouge. Tell us what we can do to help the mayor. So someone who comes in from the outside, I don't think necessarily gains that.
Crime is a big issue.
Exactly.
You talked about it during the campaign, but it's gotten worse, and it's gotten worse in various parts of the country. But
right.
Here in Baton Rouge, we've had a tough year.
No question. And Sharon and I over the weekend had a discussion, and she talked about the crime issue and about the selection of a new chief. And I think there's some people in Baton Rouge who had the feeling that Sharon is anti-police. And her statement to me was an interesting one. She said, you know, police reform does not mean that you're anti-police. I think we all understand that we have things in the police department that need to be streamlined. Mm-hmm. Community policing is a big outcry. And that's not just a buzzword. It takes a lot to get that together. I think it takes a different approach, and it's going to take some investment in policing.
Will you continue your business dealings?
I was just making a call before. I'm basically finding people who will take that stuff away. I think, you know, I have to focus on this and the ethics of it, too. I need to make sure that there's no ethical issue in any way that anybody can point fingers at.
Well, you're a guy who almost single-handedly rebuilt Spanish Town, and I'm not exaggerating. He had a big part about it. And when you look at that area, how can that be replicated in other parts of the city?
Well, I think the interesting thing, Jim, is 30 years ago when I bought a piece of property in Spanish Town, really as a college kid, it was where people are making complaints in North Baton Rouge. That's exactly where we were. We were at the very bottom of the totem pole. We had one city official who came once to a civic association meeting, excuse me, and we had a number of public works issues that we couldn't get resolved, and we asked the guy why our complaints weren't getting addressed. He said, you have to understand, when things come in from your neighborhood, they go to the bottom of the list. And when he repeated that for the third time, I said, is there an explanation? He said, it's an old neighborhood. It's hard to come in here and fix anything. We fix it in one spot, it breaks somewhere else. So we've dealt with all those public service type issues. And I think that's one thing that I bring is an understanding of what it's like from the citizen standpoint when city government says we can't help, we can't fix something.
Right. Well, hopefully we will have Daryl back many times, but Jessica asked a question that we'll close with, and it's a pertinent one. She asked if some people were poised to oppose the mayor from the very start.
I think that's exactly the case, and I think that's what I talked about in the campaign, that what happens is that we polarize ourselves based on what our voting base is. And once that happens, it sets a path, and it's hard to break that path. And that's where we are today.
Well, is it possible that we can unite? Or we talk about it, but is it possible to put it into a
I think Sharon
situation?
Has the personality to do that. That's her desire and her goal, and I'm there to help her do that.
And you come, as I mentioned, from various backgrounds, but she was a journalist, and you were
exactly.
A realtor,
right?
And now you're running the city. That's and you came into Baton Rouge at about the same time,
right?
So you have some things in common, and I think you obviously have the passion for the city that is first and foremost. But it's going to take some heavy lifting.
No question.
You're no newcomer. You know it's.
Right.
It's going to come easy.
I was at the voting polls on Saturday, and someone introduced me to a new polling commissioner, explained what my new job was. And the guy complained that he had a pothole he was trying to get fixed. And he said, why can't the city have the same slogan as Morris Bart? One call, that's all. And I'm like, that's our motto. That's where we want to be.
I didn't know Morris Bart was going to be mentioned. One call, that's all. But thank you, Daryl, and congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.